time is 9 p.m. You're listening to KBMR FM, Nevada City. My name is T.E. Wolf, and this is A Word in Edgewise. Tonight's program, part one of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Will be a three-part presentation starting tonight, continuing next Sunday, December 20th, and concluding Sunday, December 27th. Marley was dead, to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it, and Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was dead as a doornail. Mind, I don't mean to say that I know of my own knowledge what there is particularly dead about a doornail. I might have been inclined myself to regard a coffin nail as the deadest piece of ironmongery in the trade, but the wisdom of our ancestors is in the simile, and my unhallowed hands shall not disturb it when the country's done for. You will therefore permit me to repeat emphatically that Marley was as dead as a doornail. Scrooge knew he was dead. Of course he did. How could it be otherwise? Scrooge and he were partners for I don't know how many years. Scrooge was his sole executor, his sole administrator, his sole friend, and sole mourner. Scrooge never painted out old Marley's name. There it stood, years afterward, above the warehouse door, Scrooge and Marley. The firm was known as Scrooge and Marley. Sometimes people new to the business called Scrooge Scrooge, and sometimes Marley, but he answered both names. It was all the same to him. He was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. Hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire. Secret and self-contained, and solitary as an oyster. Cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his thin lips blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. A frosty rime was on his head and on his eyebrows and his wiry chin. He carried his own low temperature always about with him. He iced his office in the dog days and didn't thaw it 1 degree at Christmas. Nobody ever stopped him in the street to say, with gladsome looks, "My dear Scrooge, how are you? When will you come to see me?" No beggars implored him to bestow a trifle. No children asked him what it was o'clock. No man or woman ever once in all his life inquired the way to such and such a place of Ebenezer Scrooge. Even the blind men's dogs appeared to know him, and when they saw him coming on, would tug their owners into doorways and up courts, and then would wag their tails as though they said, "No eye at all is better than an evil eye, dark master." But what did Scrooge care? It was the very thing he liked, to edge his way along the crowded paths of life, warning all human sympathy to keep its distance. Once upon a time, of all the good days in the year, on Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house. It was cold, bleak, biting weather, freezing withal, and he could hear the people in the court outside go wheezing up and down, beating their hands upon their breasts and stamping their feet upon the pavement stones to warm them. The city clocks had only just gone 3, but it was quite dark already. It had not been light all day. And candles were flaring in the windows of the neighboring offices, like ruddy smears upon the palpable brown air. The fog came pouring in at every chink and keyhole, and was so dense without that although the court was of the narrowest, the houses opposite were mere phantoms. The door of Scrooge's counting house was open, that he might keep his eye upon his clerk, who was copying letters in a dismal little cell beyond. Sort of tank, really. Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal. But he couldn't replenish it, for Scrooge kept the coal box in his own room, and so surely as the clerk came in with a shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Wherefore the clerk put on his white comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle, in which effort, not being a man of strong imagination, he failed. A Merry Christmas, Uncle! God save you! It was Scrooge's nephew, ruddy and handsome, smoking still from his brisk walk outside, who came upon his uncle so quickly, quite startled the older man.
"Bah! Humbug!" said Scrooge.
"Christmas a humbug, Uncle? You don't mean that, I'm sure."
"I do. Merry Christmas. What right have you to be merry? What reason have you to be merry? You're poor enough."
"Well, come then, Uncle. What right have you to be dismal? What reason have you to be morose? You're rich enough." Scrooge, having no better answer ready on the spur of the moment, said again,
"Bah!"
and followed it up with,
"Humbug!"
"Be cross, Uncle," said the nephew.
"What else can I be," returned the uncle, "when I live in such a world of fools as this? Merry Christmas! Out upon Merry Christmas! What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills without money? A time for finding yourself a year older and not an hour richer? Time for balancing your books and having every item in 'em through a round dozen of months presented dead against you? If I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart.
Uncle!
Nephew! Keep Christmas in your own way, and let me keep it in mine.
Keep it? But you don't keep it.
Let me leave it alone, then. Much good may it do you. Much good it has ever done you.
There are many things from which I might have derived good that I have not profited, I dare say. Christmas being one of them. But I'm sure I have always thought of Christmas time when it has come round as a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time, the only time I know of in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-up hearts freely, to think of people beneath them as fellow passengers to the grave, and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. And therefore, Uncle, though it has never put a scrap of gold or silver in my pocket, I believe it has done me good, and will do me good, and I say God bless it. The clerk in the tank involuntarily applauded. And then, becoming immediately aware of the impropriety, he poked the fire and extinguished the last frail spark forever. Scrooge rounded on him.
Let me hear another sound from you, and you'll keep your Christmas by losing your situation.
You're quite a powerful speaker, sir, he added to his nephew. I wonder you don't go into Parliament. Don't be angry, Uncle. Come dine with us tomorrow. Scrooge said that he would see him in... Well, he went the whole length of the expression and said that he would see him in that extremity first.
But why?
Cried the nephew.
Why?
Why did you get married?
Because I fell in love.
Because you fell in love.
Scrooge growled, as if that were the only one thing in the world more ridiculous than a Merry Christmas.
Good afternoon.
Nay, Uncle, but you never came to see me before that happened. Why give it as a reason for not coming now?
Good afternoon.
I want nothing from you. I ask nothing of you. Why can we not be friends?
Good afternoon.
Well, I am sorry with all my heart to find you so resolute. We have never had any quarrel to which I have been a party. But I have made the trial in homage to Christmas, and I'll keep my Christmas humor to the last. So, a Merry Christmas, Uncle.
Good afternoon.
And a Happy New Year.
Good afternoon!
The nephew left the room without an angry word, notwithstanding. He stopped at the outer door to bestow the greetings of the season on the clerk, who, cold as he was warmer than Scrooge, for he returned them cordially.
"There's another fellow," muttered Scrooge, overhearing them. "My clerk, 15 shillings a week and a wife and family, talking about a Merry Christmas. I'll retire to Bedlam."
This lunatic, letting Scrooge's nephew out, had let two other people in. They were portly gentlemen, pleasant to behold, and now stood with their hats off in Scrooge's office. They had books and papers in their hands and bowed to him.
"Scrooge and Marley's, I believe," said one of the gentlemen, referring to his list. "Have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley?"
"Mr. Marley has been dead these 7 years. He died 7 years ago this very night."
"We have no doubt his liberality is well represented by his surviving partner," said the gentleman, presenting his credentials. He was most correct in this assumption, for they had been two kindred spirits, Scrooge and Marley. At the ominous word liberality,
Scrooge frowned and shook his head and handed the credentials back.
At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge, it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and destitute who suffer greatly at the present time. Many thousands are in want of common necessaries. Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comforts, sir.
Are there no prisons?
Plenty of prisons, sir.
And the union workhouses, are they still in operation?
They are. Still, I wish I could say they were not.
The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigor, then?
Both very busy, sir.
Oh, I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course. I'm very glad to hear it.
Well, under the impression that they scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the multitude, a few of us, businessmen such as yourself, are endeavoring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We choose this time because it is a time of all others when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What shall I put you down for?
Nothing.
You wish to be anonymous?
I wish to be left alone. Since you ask me what I wish, gentlemen, that is my answer. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough. Those who are badly off must go there.
Many can't go there, sir, and many would rather die.
If they would rather die, then they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. Besides, Scrooge added, it's not my business. It's enough for a man to understand his own business and not to interfere with other people's. Mine occupies me constantly. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Seeing clearly that it would be useless to pursue their point, the gentleman withdrew. Scrooge resumed his labors with an improved opinion of himself, in quite a better temper than was usual with him. Fog and darkness thickened throughout the remainder of the workday. Sounds from outside filtered into the counting house. Sounds of merriment from those who could afford it. And even laughter from the ragged men and boys who gathered around gas pipes and open fire. The wealthy and the poor alike. The owner of one scant young nose, gnawed and mumbled by the hungry cold as bones are gnawed by dogs, stooped down at Scrooge's keyhole to regale him with a Christmas carol. But at the very sound of "God bless you, merry gentlemen, may nothing you dismay," Scrooge seized the ruler with such energy of action that the singer fled in terror, leaving the keyhole to the fog and frost. At length the hour of shutting up the counting house arrived. With an ill will, Scrooge dismounted from his stool and tacitly admitted the fact to the expectant clerk in the tank, who
instantly snuffed his candle out and put on his hat. You'll want all day tomorrow, I suppose.
If quite convenient, sir.
It's not convenient, and it's not fair. If I was to stop half a crown for it, you'd think yourself ill-used, I'll be bound.
The clerk smiled faintly. And yet, said Scrooge, you don't think me ill-used when I pay a day's wages for no work.
The clerk observed that it was only once a year. A poor excuse for picking a man's pocket every 25th of December. But I suppose you must have the whole day. Be here all the earlier the next morning.
The clerk promised that he would. And Scrooge, buttoning his greatcoat to the chin, walked out with a growl.
Scrooge took his melancholy dinner in his usual melancholy tavern, having read all the newspapers, and beguiled the rest of the evening with his banker's book, went home to bed. He lived in chambers which had once belonged to his deceased partner. They were a gloomy suite of rooms, for nobody lived in it but Scrooge, the other rooms being all let out as offices. The yard was so dark that even Scrooge, who knew its every stone, was fain to grope with his hands. Now it is a fact that there was nothing at all particular about the knocker on the front door, except that it was very large. It is also a fact that Scrooge had seen it night and morning during his whole residence in that place. Also that Scrooge had as little of what is called fancy about him as any man in the city of London. Let it also be borne in mind that Scrooge had not bestowed one thought on Marley since his last mention of his 7 years dead partner that afternoon. And then let any man explain to me, if he can, how it happened that Scrooge, having his key in the lock of the door, saw in the knocker, without its undergoing any intermediate process of change, not a knocker, but Marley's face. Yes, Marley's face. It was not in impenetrable shadow as the other objects in the yard were, but had a dismal light about it like a bad lobster in a dark cellar. Was not angry or ferocious, but looked at Scrooge as Marley used to look, with ghostly spectacles turned up upon its ghostly forehead. The hair was curiously stirred, as if by breath or hot air, and though the eyes were wide open, they were perfectly motionless. As Scrooge looked fixedly at this phenomenon, it was a knocker again. To say that he was not startled or that his blood was not conscious of a terrible sensation to which it had been a stranger from infancy would be untrue. But he put his hand upon the key he had relinquished, turned it sturdily, walked in, and lighted his candle. He did pause with a moment's irresolution before he shut the door, and he did look cautiously behind it first, as if he half expected to be terrified with the sight of Marley's pigtail sticking out into the hall. But there was nothing on the back of the door except the screws and nuts that held the knocker on. So he said, "Bah!" and closed it with a bang. The sound resounded through the house like thunder. Every room above and every cask in the wine merchant's cellar below appeared to have a separate peal of echoes of its own. Scrooge was not a man to be frightened by echoes. He fastened the door and walked across the hall and up the stairs, slowly, trimming his candle as he went, not caring a button for how dark it was. Darkness is cheap, and Scrooge liked it. But before he shut his heavy door, he walked through his rooms to see that all was right. He had just enough recollection of the face to desire to do that. Sitting room, bedroom, lumber room, all as they should be. Nobody under the table, nobody under the sofa. Small fire in the grate, spoon and basin ready, a little saucepan of gruel upon the hob. Nobody under the bed, nobody in the closet, nobody in his dressing gown, which was hanging up in a suspicious attitude against the wall. Lumber room as usual, old fire guard, old shoes, two fish baskets, washing stand on three legs, and a poker. Quite satisfied, he closed his door and locked himself in. Double locked himself in, which was not his custom. Thus, secured against surprise, he took off his cravat, put on his dressing gown and slippers and his nightcap, sat down before the fire to take his gruel. It was a very low fire indeed, nothing on such a bitter night. He was obliged to sit close to it and brood over it before he could extract the least sensation of warmth from such a handful of fuel. No matter where he looked in his abode, the image of Marley's face kept coming back to him.
"Humbug," said Scrooge. He stood and walked across the room.
After several turns, he sat down again. As he threw his head back in the chair, his glance happened to rest upon a bell, a disused bell that hung in the room, communicated, for some purpose now forgotten, with a chamber in the highest story of the building. It was with great astonishment and with a strange, inexplicable dread that as he looked, he saw this bell begin to swing. It swung so softly in the outset that it scarcely made a sound, but soon it rang out loudly, and so did every other bell in the house. This might have lasted half a minute, but it seemed an hour. The bells ceased as they had begun, together. They were followed by a strange clanking noise deep down below, a sound as of chains dragging over the casks in the wine merchant's cellar. Scrooge heard the cellar door fly open with a booming sound, and then he heard the noise much closer, much louder, on the floor below him. Coming nearer.
"Humbug still. I won't believe it."
His color changed, though, when without a pause it came on through the heavy door and passed into the room before his eyes. Upon its coming in, the dying flame leaped up and fell again. The same face. The very same. Marley in his pigtail, his waistcoat, tights and boots, the tassels bristling like his pigtail and his coat skirts and the hair upon his head. The chain he drew was clasped about his middle. It was long and wound about him like a tail, It was made of cash boxes, keys, padlocks, ledgers, deeds, and heavy purses, wrought in steel. His body was transparent, so that Scrooge, observing him, looking through his waistcoat, could see the two buttons on his coat behind. Though he looked at the phantom through and through and saw it standing before him, though he felt the chilling influence of its death-cold eyes and marked the very texture of the folded kerchief bound about its head and chin, he was still incredulous and fought against his senses. "How now?" he said, caustic and cold as ever. "What do you want with me?" "Much." Marley's voice. No doubt about it. "Who are you?" "Ask me who I was." "Who were you, then?" "Very particular for a shade." "In life, I was your partner, Jacob Marley." "No, no, no, no. You don't believe in me."
"I don't."
"What evidence would you have of my reality beyond that of your senses?"
"I don't know."
"Why do you doubt your senses?"
"Because any little thing affects them. A slight disorder of the stomach makes them cheats. You may be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato. There's more of gravy than of grave about you, whatever you are."
Scrooge was not much in the habit of cracking jokes, nor did he feel in his heart by any means waggish just then. The truth is that he tried to be smart, as a means of distracting his own attention, keeping down his terror, for the specter's voice disturbed the very marrow in his bones. To this end, and to divert the vision's stony gaze from himself, he said,
"You see this toothpick?"
"I do."
"You are not looking at it."
"But I see it notwithstanding."
"Well, I have but to swallow this and be for the rest of my days persecuted by a legion of goblins, all of my own creation. Humbug, I tell you. Humbug!"
At this, the spirit raised a frightful cry and shook its chain with such a dismal and appalling noise that Scrooge held on tight to his chair to save himself from falling in a swoon. But how much greater was his horror when the phantom, taking off the bandage round its head as if it were too warm to wear indoors, its lower jaw dropped down upon its breast. Scrooge fell upon his knees and clasped his hands before his face.
"Mercy! Dreadful apparition! Why do you trouble me?"
"Man of the worldly mind, do you believe in me or not?"
"I do. I must. But why do spirits walk the earth, and why do they come to me?"
"It is required of every man that the spirit within him should walk abroad among his fellow men and travel far and wide. And if that spirit goes not forth in life, it is condemned to do so after death.
It is doomed to wander through the world, oh, and witness what it cannot share, but might have shared on Earth, and turned to happiness. Again the specter raised a cry and shook its chain and wrung its shadowy hands.
You are fettered, spirit. Tell me why.
I wear the chain I forged in life. I made it link by link and yard by yard. I girded it on of my own free will, and of my own free will I wore it. Is its pattern strange to you? Or would you know the weight and length of the strong coil you bear yourself? It was full as heavy, and as long as this, 7 Christmas Eves ago. You have labored on it since. It is a ponderous chain.
Scrooge glanced about him on the floor in the expectation of finding himself surrounded by some 50 or 60 fathoms of iron cable. But he could see nothing.
Jacob! Old Jacob Marley, tell me more. Speak comfort to me, Jacob.
I have none to give. It comes from other regions, Ebenezer Scrooge, and is conveyed by other ministers to other kinds of men. Nor can I tell you what I would. A very little more is all permitted to me. I cannot rest. I cannot stay. I cannot linger anywhere. My spirit never walked beyond our counting house. Mark me. In life, my spirit never roved beyond the narrow limits of our money-changing hole. And weary journeys lie before me.
But you were always a good man of business, Jacob.
Business. Mankind was my business. The common good was my business. Charity, mercy, benevolence were all my business.
It held up its chain at arm's length as if that were the cause of all its unavailing grief, and flung it heavily upon the ground again.
At this time of the rolling year I suffer most. Why did I walk through crowds of fellow beings with my eyes turned down and never raise them to that blessed star which led the wise men to a poor abode? Were there no poor homes to which its light could have conducted me?
Scrooge was very much dismayed to hear the specter going on at this rate, and began to quake exceedingly.
Hear me, my time is nearly gone.
I will, but don't be hard upon me. Don't be flowery, Jacob, pray.
How it is that I appear before you in a shape that you can see, I may not tell. I have sat invisible beside you many and many a day.
It was not an agreeable idea. Scrooge shivered and wiped the perspiration from his brow.
That is no light part of my penance. I am here tonight to warn you that you have a chance and a hope of escaping my fate. A chance and hope of my procuring Ebenezer.
You were always a good friend to me, Jacob. Thank ye.
You will be haunted by 3 spirits.
Scrooge's countenance fell almost as low as the ghost's had done.
Is that the chance and hope you mentioned, Jacob?
It is.
then I think I'd rather not.
Without their visits, you cannot hope to shun the path I tread. Expect the first tomorrow, when the bell tolls one.
Couldn't I take them all at once and have it over, Jacob?
Expect the second on the next night at the same hour. The third upon the next night, when the last stroke of 12 has ceased to vibrate. Look to see me no more. And look that for your own sake you remember what has passed between us.
When it had said these words, the spectre took its wrapper from its table and bound its round head as before. Scrooge noted with horror the smart sound its teeth made when the jaws were brought together by the bandage. And the apparition walked backward from him, winding its chain round its arm, and in every step it took, the window raised itself a little, so that when the spectre reached it, it was wide open. Beckoned Scrooge to approach, which he did. When they were within 2 paces of each other, Marley's ghost held up its hand, warning him to come no nearer. Scrooge stopped, not so much in obedience as in surprise and fear, for on the raising of the hand he became aware of confused noises in the air, incoherent sounds of lamentation and regret, wailings inexpressibly sorrowful and self-accusatory. The spectre, after listening for a moment, joined in the mournful dirge and floated out upon the bleak, dark night. Scrooge followed to the window, desperate in his curiosity, and looked out. The air was filled with phantoms, wandering here and there in restless haste, moaning as they went. Every one of them wore chains like Marley's ghost. Some few were linked together. None were free. Many had been personally known to Scrooge in their lives. He had been quite familiar with one old ghost in a white waistcoat with a monstrous iron safe attached to its ankle, who cried piteously at being unable to assist a wretched woman with an infant whom it saw below upon a doorstep. The misery with them all was, clearly, that they sought to interfere for good in human matters, and had lost the power forever. Whether these creatures faded into mist or mist enshrouded them, he could not tell, but they and their spirit voices faded together, and the night became as it had been when he walked home. Scrooge closed the window and examined the door by which the ghost had entered. It was double-locked, as he had locked it with his own hands, and the bolts were undisturbed. He tried to say humbug, but stopped at the first syllable. And being, from the emotion he had undergone, or the fatigues of the day, or his glimpse of the invisible world, or the dull conversation of the ghost, or the lateness of the hour, much in need of repose, went straight to bed without undressing, and fell asleep upon the instant. When Scrooge awoke, it was so dark that looking out of bed, he could scarcely distinguish the transparent window from the opaque walls of his chamber. He was endeavoring to pierce the darkness with his ferret eyes, when the chimes of the neighboring church struck the hour. And to his great astonishment, the heavy bell went on from 6 to 7, and from 7 to 8, and regularly all the way up to 12, and then stopped. It was past 2 when he went to bed. The clock was wrong. It had to be. An icicle must have gotten stuck in the works. 12. How could that be? Why, it isn't possible, said Scrooge, that I can have slept through a whole day and far into another night. It isn't possible that anything has happened to the sun, and this is 12 at noon. The idea being an alarming one, he scrambled out of bed and groped his way to the window. He was obliged to rub the frost off with the sleeve of his dressing gown before he could see anything. He could see very little then. All he could make out was that it was still very foggy and extremely cold, and that there was no noise of people running to and fro and making a great stir, as there unquestionably would have been if night had beaten off bright day and taken possession of the world. Scrooge went to bed again and thought and thought, and thought it over and over, and could make nothing of it. The more he thought, the more perplexed he was. The more he endeavored not to think, the more he thought. Marley's ghost bothered him exceedingly. Every time he resolved within himself, after mature inquiry, that it was all a dream, his mind flew back again like a strong spring released to its first position, and presented the same problem to be worked all through. Was it a dream or not? Scrooge lay in this state until the chime had gone 3/4 more, when he remembered on a sudden that the ghost had warned him of a visitation when the bell tolled 1. He resolved to lie awake until the hour was past, and considering that he could no more go to sleep than go to heaven, this was perhaps the wisest resolution in his power. The quarter was so long that he was more than once convinced that he must have sunk into a doze unconsciously and missed the clock, but at length it broke upon his listening ear. A quarter past. A half past. A quarter to it. And the hour itself, and nothing else. He spoke before the hour bell sounded, which it now did with a deep, hollow, melancholy 1. Light flashed up in the room upon the instant, and the curtains of his bed were drawn. Drawn aside, I tell you, by a hand. Not the curtains at his feet, nor the curtains at his back, but those to which his face was addressed. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, and Scrooge, starting up, found himself face to face with the unearthly visitor, who drew them. As close as I am now to you, and I am standing in the spirit at your elbow. It was a strange figure, like a child, yet not so like a child as like an old man viewed through some supernatural medium which gave him the appearance of having receded from view and being diminished to a child's proportions. Its hair, which hung about its neck and down its back, was white as if with age, and yet the face had not a wrinkle in it. The tenderest bloom was on the skin. The arms were very long and muscular, and the hands the same, as if its holds were of uncommon strength. Its legs and feet were bare. wore a tunic of the purest white, and round its waist was bound a lustrous belt, the sheen of which was beautiful. It held a branch of fresh green holly in its hand, and in singular contradiction of that wintry emblem, had its dress trimmed with summer flowers. But the strangest thing about it was that from the crown of its head, there sprung a bright, clear jet of light by which all this was visible, which was doubtless the occasion of its using in its duller moments a great extinguisher for a cap which it now held under its arms.
"Are you the spirit, sir, whose coming was foretold to me?"
"I am." The voice was soft and gentle, singularly low, as if instead of being so close beside him, it were at a distance.
"Who and what are you?"
"I am the ghost of Christmas past."
"Long past?"
"No. Your past."
"Spirit, your light, it's too bright, I beg you. Please, don that cap for pity's sake."
"Would you so soon put out with worldly hands the light I give? Is it not enough that you are one of those whose passions made this cap, and force me through whole trains of years to wear it low upon my brow?" Scrooge reverently disclaimed all intention to offend, or any knowledge of having willfully bonneted the spirit in any period of his life. He then made bold to inquire what business brought him there.
"Your welfare."
Scrooge expressed himself much obliged, but could not help thinking that a night of unbroken rest would have been more conducive to that end.
"Your reclamation, then. Take heed."
It put out its strong hand as it spoke and clasped him gently by the arm.
"Rise and walk with me."
It would have been in vain for Scrooge to plead that the weather and the hour were not adapted to pedestrian purposes, that bed was warm and the thermometer a long way below freezing, that he was clad but lightly in his slippers, dressing gown, and nightcap, that he had a cold upon him at the time. The grasp, though gentle as a woman's hand, was not to be resisted. He rose, but finding that the spirit made towards the window, clasped his robe in supplication.
"Spirit, I am mortal and liable to fall."
"Bear but a touch of my hand there, upon your heart, and you shall be upheld in more than this." As the words were spoken, they passed through the wall and stood upon an open country road with fields on either end. The city had entirely vanished. Not a vestige of it was to be seen. The darkness and the mist had vanished with it, for it was a clear, cold winter day with snow upon the ground.
"Good heaven," said Scrooge, clasping his hand together. "I was raised in this place. I was a boy here."
The spirit gazed upon him mildly, its gentle touch still reverberating in the old man's heart. He was conscious of a thousand odors floating in the air, each one connected with a thousand thoughts and hopes and joys and cares long, long forgotten.
"Your lip is trembling," said the ghost. "And what is that upon your cheek?"
Scrooge muttered with an unusual catching in his voice that it was a pimple, and begged the ghost to lead him where he would.
"Do you recollect the way?"
"Remember it. I could walk it blindfold."
"Strange to have forgotten it for so many years," observed the ghost. "Let us go on."
They walked along the road, Scrooge recognizing every gate and post and tree, until a little market town appeared in the distance, with its bridge, its church, and winding river. A group of boys on shaggy ponies trotted past. And as they came, Scrooge knew and named every one of them, shouting, "Hello, hello!" and other salutations.
"These are but shadows of the things that have been," said the ghost. "They have no consciousness of us."
In a moment they were past and gone, leaving Scrooge and his guide alone on the road.
"The school is not quite deserted," said the ghost. "A solitary child, neglected by his friends, is left there still."
Scrooge said he knew it, and he sobbed. They left the high road by a well-remembered lane and soon approached a mansion of dull red brick with a little weathercock surmounted cupola on the roof and a bell hanging in it. It was a large house, but one of broken fortunes, for the spacious offices were little used, their walls were damp and mossy, their windows broken, their gates decayed. They went, the Scrooge and the ghost, across the hall to a door at the back of the house. It opened before them and disclosed a long, bare, melancholy room, made barer still by lines of empty desks, empty, that is, save for one. At this, a lonely boy was reading near a feeble fire, and Scrooge leaned against a wall and wept to see his poor, forgotten self as he used to be. Not a latent echo in the house. Not a latent echo in the house. Not a squeak and scuffle from the mice behind the paneling. Not a drip from the half-thawed water spout in the dull yard behind. No, not a clicking in the fire, but fell upon the heart of Scrooge with softening influence and gave a freer passage to his tears. The spirit touched him on the arm and pointed to his younger self, intent upon his reading. "Poor boy," Scrooge muttered. "I wish... but it's too late now." "What is the matter?" "Nothing, nothing. There was a boy singing a Christmas carol at my door last night. I should like to have given him something, that's all." The ghost smiled thoughtfully and waved its hand, saying as it did so, "Let us see another Christmas." Scrooge's former self grew larger at the words, and the room became a little darker and more dirty. The panels shrunk, the windows cracked, fragments of plaster fell from the ceiling. And there he was, alone again, older, when all the other boys had gone home for the holidays. He was not reading now, but walking up and down despairingly. Waiting for anything, anyone. Scrooge looked at the ghost and with a mournful shaking of his head glanced anxiously toward the door. It opened, and a little girl, much younger than the boy, came darting in, putting her arms about his neck and kissing him and addressing him as dear brother. "I have come to take you home, dear brother. To bring you home. Home." "Home, little fan," returned the boy. "Yes, home for good and all. Home for ever and ever. Father is so much kinder than he used to be that home is like heaven. He spoke so gently to me the other night that I was not afraid to ask him once more if you might come home. And he said, yes, you should, and sent me in a coach to bring you. And you are to be a man, and you are never to come back here. But first, we're to be together all Christmas long and have the merriest time in all the world." "You are quite a woman, little fan," exclaimed the boy. She clapped her hands and laughed and tried to touch his head, but being too little, laughed again and stood on tiptoe to embrace him.
Then she began to drag him in her childish eagerness towards the door, and he, with no argument, accompanied her down the hall to the waiting coach.
"Always a delicate creature, whom a breath might have withered," said the ghost. "But she had a large heart."
"So she had," cried Scrooge. "You're right, I'll not gainsay it, spirit, God forbid."
"She died a woman, and had, as I think, children."
"Yes, one child."
"Your nephew."
Scrooge seemed uneasy in his mind and answered briefly,
"Yes,"
thinking, no doubt, of their most recent encounter and the harshness of his words with the young man.
"My uncle. I am his uncle. He is my nephew."
"Nothing. Nothing more."